Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and I will moderate tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Robert Baer, former CIA operative and author of the new book, The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. I think we're in for a treat tonight. Robert Baer worked for more than 25 years in the Middle East, as you heard, as a member of the CIA. And tonight's discussion is quite timely. And I'm going to just leave it to him to inform, entertain, and answer our question. Please welcome Robert Baer.
Thank you very much. This is a bit of a homecoming for me because in 1976, I was unemployed, just graduated from college, was a student at Berkeley studying Chinese, and working at the day-night division of Bank of America. Those old enough to remember that it was open at night. We used to have a police teller. Anyhow, I was running out of money, and I was living with a friend on his couch, and he suggested I get a job. And that was a novel idea, so I called the Federal Center, which I think is right on the corner, and said, can I talk to the CIA? It was the Pike Church Committee in those days, and they gave me a number in Lawndale, California, and the rest was history, and I was hired, and now I'm back. And one of the first things I learned in the CIA was you were the least important person in the room. Never make yourself public. Of course, I didn't understand that lesson based on my performance now, but in any case, I was, in spite of my Chinese, I was sent to the Middle East, and, well, they sent me to Arabic for 2 years, and I ended up in the Middle East and ran smack dab into Beirut, 1982, and for me, all knowledge is based on extreme pain, disappointment, fear, whatever. And that occurred April 1983, when a young man drove up the Corniche in a GMC pickup truck, waited at the end of the Corniche, and it was a beautiful day in Beirut. The Israelis had just departed. Democracy was coming to Lebanon. Lebanon was about to recognize Israel. It was going to be a new era for America and Israel in the Middle East. This young man sat at the end of the Corniche and waited. He was waiting for a signal. It was a little before noon. A Mercedes came roaring up the Corniche, waved at the guy in the pickup truck, who started up. The truck was low on its springs, headed down the Corniche. The entire world was unsuspecting. Schools were getting out. Traffic was double parked, people picking up their kids. And when the truck got to the U.S. Embassy, it made an abrupt left, went under the Corniche, under the portico the wrong way, drove into the lobby, and exploded. It had an effect that we feel today. Aside from the dozens of people killed, it ended up, this one attack, in driving the United States out of Lebanon and Israel as well. This was the first time the United States had been militarily defeated in the Middle East. It was the first time we were forced to leave a country because of terrorism. But for me, as a CIA operative, was the brilliance of the operation. We have to put our, you know, I lost a lot of friends in that embassy, but we have to put that aside. The Palestinians were never able to conduct an operation like this in the years they'd been fighting Israel and the United States. Going back to the 60s, all the hijackings. One, the operation was claimed by a fictional organization, one without a return address, the Islamic Jihad Organization. Number two, we never did know who the suicide bomber was. Where does this sort of discipline come from? I spent the next 21 years in the CIA trying to piece together, formally and informally, investigating this attack. What we found out, and I'd like to add a footnote here, is I've written a couple books, and I make a lot of big assertions to facts and events. A professional journalist or a scholar would source their stuff. They would put footnotes, describe the sourcing in the paragraphs, and say, this is where I got it from. I cannot do that. Everything I write is sent to the CIA. They do not take out criticism, but they do take out what they consider classified information. They have a perfect right to do that, and it's a system that works. I'm just happy that I can put out what I can. So anyhow, what we found out in the course of this investigation, it was Iran who conducted this operation. It was Iran who paid for it, trained the people, brought the explosives in. It was Iran who covered it up. We know the names of the people who actually conducted this operation in Tehran, that it was approved by the leadership. As you know, this went on to the attack on the Marines, attack on another U.S. embassy. But as significant, we got up and left, and what couldn't happen was the Israelis couldn't get up and just leave like that. In getting rid of the Palestinians, they turned over the resistance in Lebanon to what became known as the Islamic Resistance, which fought an 18-year war against the Israelis. But more than anything, it was a war that the Iranians and an organization that became known as Hezbollah learned how to fight. We have to take the word of the Israelis. In those 18 years, they were defeated militarily, the first time in Israel's history since 1948. A lot of Israeli politicians, as we did in Vietnam, will say, well, this was a political defeat. Nope, we chose to leave voluntarily. 2006 war, the Israelis were beaten. 34 days, Hezbollah rocketed Israel. It disabled a corvette, an Israeli it was a surveillance ship mainly. And the day the Israelis left, the same number of rockets were falling on Israeli cities. The Winograd Commission has said we were defeated. It's difficult to describe to you the effect this has had in the Middle East. The fact that a Muslim army, essentially, backed by a state, was able to fight the Israelis to a standstill. The amount of credit that Iran has gotten for this is incalculable for us because we don't understand the fear that has traversed the Middle East after this war. To make the situation even more dire in terms of people living in the Middle East is Iraq. This administration invaded Iraq for pretty much the reasons they said they did. They believed there were weapons of mass destruction. They obviously didn't understand intelligence because the CIA had very clearly told the White House, well, we don't know. They could be there or they could not be there. Nonetheless, what essentially happened in Iraq is that we got rid of a Sunni-led army, an elite Praetorian Guard. But more than that, it was the shield of the Arabs, the shield of the Sunni Arabs. In Afghanistan, in destroying the Taliban, we just like we destroyed Saddam, we destroyed Iran's enemy. So what we're talking about now is that Iran had two unsought victories, Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, they didn't lose anybody in those two wars and in Lebanon where they learned how to fight. Additionally, during these 18 years since 1982, 1983, when they were fighting this war in Lebanon, the Iranians fought a very vicious war in Iraq. They lost from 1 million to 2 million people. The fact is that we don't know how many people the Iranians lost. It tells a whole story of how devastating this war was. inside the CIA, we had assumed that Iran was a spent force. It was fought to a standstill with the Iraqis. It was a hopelessly violently terrorist country. It couldn't last. The economy was collapsing. It was a power we could pretty much ignore because it was going to collapse under its own weight. What in fact happened was that Iran combined lessons of Lebanon, what the army calls asymmetrical warfare, the lessons they learned in these 18 years of warfare against us in Israel. They combined that with Russian and Chinese weapons and blackmail to create what I call an empire. And it's a big word, but let me go back and try to explain what I mean. One is the blackmail. The blackmail is Iran's ability to take off within 3 minutes 17 million barrels of traded oil that pass through the Strait of Hormuz. All they have to do is sink a couple tankers, insurance is withdrawn, oil, the strait closes down. Secondly, they have trained missiles, silkworm missiles, at Saudi Arabia's oil facilities, at Opaque, for instance. One missile could take out 6 million barrels of oil a day. Up to 2 years, the damage would last. So essentially, the Iranians have control over 55% of the world's proven oil reserves in the Middle East, should they choose to exercise that. Which brings us to the question, what does Iran want? It has what I think is the outlines of an empire in Lebanon, Iraq, Afghanistan. It's an empire by proxy. It's an empire. These proxies run through Gaza, the Islamic Jihad organization, Hamas. If we take Iran's record going back to the attack on the U.S. embassy in 1983 and follow it through the hostage taking, the attacks in Buenos Aires, they attacked the Israeli embassy and the Israeli the Jewish cultural center there. If we take the attack on Khobar barracks, it is pretty much as the neocons have described it, as a terrorist state. But if we look at the timeline and what's happened to Iran since the attack on the embassy, you see a subsiding of support for terrorism and more of a support for conventional military power via proxy, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and organizations I've just mentioned. But more to the point is that in 1996, the Iranians attacked a military target in Saudi Arabia, Khobar barracks, and that was their last one. I've tried to run down the stories of their sponsoring attacks in Iraq, and the only one that I can certainly pinpoint is the attack in Karbala, which is 2 years ago. Five American soldiers were killed. The evidence suggests it was Iran in retaliation for taking five Iranian diplomats. But the explosively formed projectiles in Iraq, the other weapons, the support for the militias is not directed against the United States. What Iran is doing is preparing for the day we leave. So let me go back one more time to 1983. We have Iran is a revolutionary state intent on driving the United States out of the Middle East, intent on overthrowing the government in Saudi Arabia, a worldwide Islamic revolution. This is what drove them into a war with Iraq in 1980. But what I see is this arc that Iran has traveled from this irrational state to a rational state. As Iran became more powerful, it became more responsible. We generally have missed this. We missed, for instance, in the 2006 war, 34-day war, the Iranians and Hezbollah had the opportunity to take dozens of Americans hostage or assassinate them, ones living in Lebanon. They didn't. The orders came down. Privately, the Iranians have said, and they've said it to me, former CIA officer, look, this is all about destroying Israel is propaganda. What we really want is military predominance in surrounding countries in the Persian Gulf. We don't care what happens with the Palestinians as long as the Palestinians accept it. If the Palestinians want Resolution 242, we'll accept it. Hezbollah says the same thing. By spending so much time in the Middle East, you start to hear a change in the tone, and you start to see, it's a maturity with the Iranians. Our problem is, because we already have enough problems in the Middle East, thinking about Iraq, is we focus on Ahmadinejad. The Iranians call him bipolar. He spent $2 million on widening the streets of Tehran for the return of the Mehdi, and he communicates with the Mehdi, the Jamkaran well, by dropping post-its down the well with, asking questions. All right, the man's not rational. He's the McCarthy of Iranian politics. But the good news is that the Khamenei, the supreme leader who replaced Khomeini, is more rational and has stood back, and he controls the military. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the people who blew up our embassy in Beirut, was irrational, but it's much more controlled at this point. They've gone out of their way in the Persian Gulf, their small boats, to avoid attacking Americans. They've avoided taking a direct role in the resistance in Iraq. It's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is held back in support of the surge. This is like night and day. When I sat down and wrote this book, I had proposed, a best and the brightest. How did we lose Iran in 1978, 1979, and how did we miss this threat? And my publisher said, you're not David Halberstam, so why don't you try to project what's happening with Iran? And subsequently to that, I have spent the last 3 years, it's not very glamorous, but talking to suicide bombers, failed ones, and I've talked to the families of suicide bombers, the ones that succeeded. And when I went into this, I had no idea what was going to come out of it. I mean, I spent almost an entire month in Israeli prison talking to Hamas and Islamic Jihad bombers. And what I found out was that the Sunni Arabs, or the Sunnis in general, are not particularly rational. They look at the world of destroying the West because we attempt to destroy them. Do unto you as you do unto us is the attitude. And what they can do is justify attacking restaurants, schools, blowing up old people. It doesn't matter. At the same time, I went to Iran and started talking to people who sponsored suicide bombings there and Hezbollah, and they could actually articulate what they were doing. And they would become furious when I would talk about or ask about the 72 virgins or the plastic keys to heaven. It doesn't seem like much to you, but the fact is that they can say, look, you people in the Second World War could justify a soldier rushing a Japanese machine gun nest. What's the difference if we put someone in a truck and blow up a military target? They were very careful, they said, I'm just passing this on, to attack military or official targets. The U.S. Embassy in Beirut, the Marines, the Israeli military. In 2006, the attack was not on an Israeli city, the initial attack. It was on an Israeli patrol. They said, we are at war with Israel. This may not be much comfort to the Israelis or anybody else being attacked by the Iranians, but what I noticed in this arc of a country becoming more rational is it will be a lot easier to negotiate a military settlement with a country like Iran as opposed to bin Laden, who we can't even find. And remember, a Sunni can get on the internet, find a fatwa justifying an attack on, the Commonwealth Club. He can get on there and find a recipe for an acetone peroxide bomb and attack, and anybody can do it. A Shia and is I have seen no exceptions, needs the permission of an imam, in this case an Ayatollah. He simply cannot wake up one day and go to war with the United States. If we look at where we are in the Middle East, Iraq will never be pieced back together. It's going to either be partitioned or it's going to be federalized in some form. What both we, you know, the United States and what the Iranians want is stability in Iraq. We want stability in Afghanistan. And my argument is that if Iran has really become rational, like I've said it has, if Ahmadinejad is not the leader, and he definitely isn't, we can negotiate with the Iranians on a military settlement for these two countries, which could lead to a wider settlement, or even, you know, it's not unthinkable an alliance. Right now it's nuclear weapons. The Iranians are very clear of why they want a nuclear weapon. We've got two armies. We've got one in Afghanistan and we've got one in Iraq. This administration has said, we're going to attack you. I mean, what was Saddam missing? He was missing a nuclear bomb. If we were to go down this route of negotiating settlements in Iraq and Afghanistan, cooperating, as we've already done in Iraq, and if it goes wider than that in Lebanon and we find something to do with Hezbollah, there is a good possibility that we could talk the Iranians out of making a nuclear bomb. We've done it with Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, and Libya. Why not Iran? Once you get to the point where you're not threatening the Iranians and treating them, you know, call them a hegemony or call them an empire by proxy or just a regional superpower, you will find the Iranians will become less paranoid. The extremists will lose much of their influence. And we could go back to a point where Iran would be the ally, much as the Shah was, the policeman of the Gulf. If Pakistan falls apart, we're going to need Iran to keep control of this. If the Taliban start to come back into Kabul and really take it, we're going to need Iran. But more than that, we're going to need Iran to divide the Iraqis. Our other choice is simply to stay in the Middle East, keep 200,000-300,000 soldiers indefinitely for the next 30 years, you know, whether it's containing Iran or holding Iraq together. But as I said, this is the arc. When I went into the CIA, Iran starts as an irrational, violent power that promised to fall apart and didn't, and found its way. And so, actually, I it always pays to be pessimistic about the Middle East, but this is a good news story. And there you have it. You ready?
Our thanks to Robert Baer, former CIA operative and author of the new book, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower, for his comments this evening. So now we're going to begin the question and answer session. So we have a lot of questions, Mr. Baer, and we'll begin. If the president-elect, let's have a hypothetical, called you tomorrow and wanted to be briefed on what strategy you would pursue with the Iranians in terms of their global strategy or superpower strategy, where would you begin and what advice can you give him?
I would begin in Iraq. I would appoint a nonpartisan Secretary of State, somebody like Lugar, a Republican, because you need to reach across the aisle, and send him to Baghdad and sit him down with the Iranians in the margins of talking about security agreements and ask the Iranians, what is it precisely you want? If you want Mecca, as there's this accusation, you don't get it. If you want to rocket Israel or destroy Israel, it's not going to happen. I think you'll get a much better reception if he sits down and says, we're leaving in 2 years. Now, we can either leave a mess in Iraq, and we'll leave a mess in Afghanistan, or we can work together. The Iranians will come around, and especially when you treat them according to the power that I think they are. And I think you'll get a hearing.
Yesterday in Tehran, Ali Kordan, the interior minister, was dismissed on an allegation of, I guess, faking his resume, sort of his bona fides. But the crucial thing here is that he was seen as a key supporter and ally of the president, Ahmadinejad. He didn't, you know, is this, can you talk a little bit about Iranian, what's going on there, and the role, really, of the mullahs and the president, and what we perceive and what reality is?
Well, I mean, you know, this is, I'm sure this is a sophisticated audience, but Khamenei, the spiritual leader, isn't truly an Ayatollah. He has a fake degree himself. He is not qualified to issue fatwas. His constituency, his power is in the military, in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. He probably poisoned Khomeini's son in a power struggle. That's the accusation, at least, to take control of the military. He is a military leader. He is the man with his finger on the trigger. He is the guy we need to talk to. Everybody has enjoyed Ahmadinejad in Iran. I mean, he's a bit of a joke. They're, you know, you hear that. I would tell the Ahmadinejad jokes, but they don't really translate into English. He's going to be gone by next year. Ali Kordan, he was an important minister. But it's a bureaucracy, a security bureaucracy that runs the country underneath the ministers. And the fact that he couldn't hold on to his interior minister, as much as you can read tea leaves in Tehran, is his days are numbered. Ahmadinejad, he'll probably be voted out. Iran's an odd country. Which incident, I got a comment on my book from Khatami, the former president, which is very odd, an email. He said it was insightful. I didn't know if he was insightful into Iran or into American thinking, but I'll take it as a compliment. They're hard to come by.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Baer, former top CIA operative in the Middle East, about what Americans do and don't know about Iran and the Middle East. Can there be, you mentioned going to Baghdad and talking to the Iranians, Secretary of State Luger, potentially. What's the role of the Israelis in this, in terms of our support of Israel, the Palestinians, and can something really be worked out without dealing with the Palestinian and Israeli issue?
Well, I think the Israelis would very much like us. You know, if you want a truth on the Middle East, go to Tel Aviv and talk to the Israelis. They're not shy about telling you exactly what they think, and they know who their enemies are. The Israelis I talk to see Iran in the same light as an empire by proxy. They didn't like getting beat, obviously, in Lebanon or in 2006. What they're terrified of is that this same method of warfare, asymmetrical warfare, will be taken to the West Bank and Gaza. There was rocketing today of Israel. You know, I don't think it's accidental that the Sunni suicide bombings in Israel have fallen off almost completely and have been replaced by rockets. And if this isn't the Iranian MO, I don't know what is. The Israelis are coming to us and said, listen, this is for you, this is an intellectual problem, almost Iran. For us, it's an existential problem. We cannot withstand an Iranian empire that's isolated, allied with Russia, allied with China, because if it continues and other dominoes fall, like Jordan or Egypt, or any number of things could happen, we're in trouble. This is not a joke. We've tended to kick Iran down the road, you know, and for the next administration, it's a third rail of American politics. It arguably cost Carter his presidency, almost cost Reagan his presidency. But for the Israelis, this is real. And they want us to do something about Iran. So if we could go and negotiate with the Iranian regime that would end up in, for instance, Hezbollah being integrated into the Lebanese army or disarmed, they'd be happy. I think what they're doing is they're coming to the White House now and said, if you don't do something, we are. Now, the question is, would they do it between now and the 20th of January? That's impossible to say. The Israelis wouldn't say, but they would need overflight clearance. They would probably have to use tactical nuclear weapons to take out the nuclear facilities in Iran. And the outcome of this, or the consequences of an attack like this, it wouldn't be pleasant in the Gulf. We'd lose, you know, the oil for one.
Would the Americans have the ability to be able to stop that?
I think the Americans could stop it by taking the initiative. Look, I always like to say that the neocons fight the Arabs to the last Israeli, and the Israelis are tired of it. They are unhappy about Iraq because the Iranians, and our ambassador last month said, look, it's Iran that's stopping the basing agreement. And you can count on it. This administration wanted a basing agreement by last Friday to help McCain and didn't get it. And if our ambassador said it's Iran, and I know Ryan Crocker, it probably is Iran stopping this basing agreement. This hasn't gone unnoticed in Tel Aviv. So what? The Israelis see the potential for Iran, but they're going to need an America paying attention that's going to help them. Otherwise, they may pull the trigger at some point, especially if Hezbollah gets out of hand. But it is a de facto state in Lebanon. They have a veto over the cabinet. They have the strongest military. They cannot let this imbalance rest as it is. So this administration is obviously going to be preoccupied by the economy come January. It's only going to get worse by January. At the same time, it's going to have to pay attention to Iran and let the Israelis know we're doing something.
The extraordinarily complicated mosaic of the Middle East, you mentioned Iran, Israel, Iraq, Saudis. What about Syria's place in the middle of all of this?
The Alawites rule in Syria. They are extremely corrupt. They are sitting on a volcano. There's been some explosions going off in Damascus, in the Sid Zainab Mosque. These are Sunni fundamentalists. I think it's undoubtedly the Syrians killed Rafiq Hariri, the Lebanese prime minister, because he was dabbling in Sunni fundamentalist politics. The evidence is pretty clear. The Syrians are, as they have been for years, on the edge. And I was in Hama in 1982, and let's never forget they flattened one of their own cities to protect the regime. They're facing that same sort of, you know, bin Laden-like resistance. They have allied themselves with Iran because Iran has the mantle of resistance. The Syrians say, all right, you know, what it boils down to is we're not fighting the Israelis, but we're on the side of the Iranians and Hezbollah who are. We could easily destabilize Syria, but what we're going to get is a Sunni fundamentalist regime there. Last week's attack was really dumb on Syria, because if the Syrians want, they could open that border again to the fundamentalists coming out of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf to go in and attack our troops. It's a fragile place, and, you know, the Syrians are only going to come around and make peace with Israel when the rest of the Middle East does, and that's going to include Iran. So they're just going to follow in Iran's footsteps because they have no choice.
One of the factors you really sort of focus on in your book, which Americans for the most part have almost no knowledge or understanding of, is the Sunni-Shia relationship. You're talking about big global issues here, but when you get down to the level of that, how is that? Where does that play out in your picture of the Iranian strategy?
Well, again, it goes back to discipline. The Shia are disciplined. There's one case where Hezbollah hijacked a Kuwaiti airliner in 1987, and the guy on the ground, who's now famous in the Middle East, Imad Mughniya, I needed to put pressure on the Kuwaitis. It was a Kuwaiti airliner. 422, and he actually went to a cleric, Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah, and said, I got to kill somebody. I have to execute one of the guards on the airplane. You'd never see this in Sunni Islam. You get a band of Qaeda types, I call them Takfiris, because they're sort of beyond the limit, and they just do what they want to do. If you like, the Sunnis are the anarchists, and the Shia are the Prussians of the Middle East. It's you lose a lot in that translation. But anyhow, I would, myself, I spent a lot of time in the Middle East. If Hezbollah says it's going to protect me going to South Lebanon or the southern suburbs, and they know I'm ex-CIA, or the Iranians let me in, give me a visa and a press card, I'll go. But I wouldn't think about going into the tribal areas of Pakistan. I just came back from Pakistan. I would never think of going there because no one could protect you. Some small group is going to grab a hold of you and think it serves their political purposes. And that's one of the lessons I live in the Middle East. They're just more disciplined. And if I had to have an ally, and I'm not talking about, you know, the morality of this conflict, but a reliable ally in the Middle East, it would be the Shia. And it's just across the board. You know, when you there was a bombing in Haifa where a woman was picked up outside of Hebron, and she drives the taxi driver, and she was taking me to the local hospital. They get to the hospital, there's guards, says, well, we can't get in there, and she says, let's get something to eat. The taxi driver sits down with her in this restaurant in Haifa, right on the beach, and she waited, you know, they ate their meal very calmly, they talked about family and about life and the West Bank and the rest of it, and she said, you better get up and leave. And he said, excuse me? She gave him money for the fare, get up and leave. So he gets up and walks away. She stands up and walks between two Israeli families, three generations, and pulls the pin. And there's Hanadi Jardot. And I went into prison and I asked her cousin who sent her. And I said, but how can you justify this? And he said, well, these kids are going to grow up, even the 2 and 3 year olds are going to grow up to be soldiers. And I said, well, you know, the Israeli extremists said, well, you're going to grow up to be terrorists. And the only argument he had at that point was they have tanks and we don't. And we weaken them as they weaken us. This kind of rationality I never met with in Tehran or with Hezbollah. They simply said, we will use whatever means we have to attack targets, military targets, in which they fought this 18. And they were very formal about it. This was a military conflict in Lebanon. And that's what they meant to keep it as. And so far, they've followed that pattern. It's not reassuring if you're an Israeli, but I would feel a lot safer with the Shia than I would with the Sunni.
You mentioned you just were in Pakistan. I'm not sure you can tell us exactly what you were doing, but do you think bin Laden's alive? And what do you think of the strategy now of sort of seeking out so-called terrorists wherever they are? And how effective will that be?
I could answer all those questions. my wife and I just adopted a Pakistani little girl, an orphan. We spent a lot of time there, and I looked up my old ISI friends. Hamid Ghul was head of the ISI, Pakistani intelligence, and bin Laden's case officer that used to meet bin Laden in the old days. It was sort of a, you know, a homecoming week. What I can tell you is we cannot operate in the tribal areas of Pakistan, ever, ever. These valleys are separated by clans and tribes. They defend their half of the valleys with anti-aircraft guns. You know, we cannot take a Pashtun speaker from Oakland and, you know, recruit him in the CIA and go look for bin Laden. They'd know exactly who he was. He would never make it up there. I would never make it up there. The Pakistani army cannot hold on up there. Which, you know, when you look at this, this area is impossible to occupy and look for bin Laden. Parallel to this, I've been asking questions. I do a lot of TV and a lot of radio, and I always go in and ask the engineer. I said, what can you do with the recording of my voice? And he says, well, I can do anything I want. I mean, And I said, you mean you could take bin Laden's voice and have him comment on the World Series and, you know, and make a statement of support to the Phillies? He says, yeah, absolutely, I could do that. So all we have from bin Laden are these very sketchy tapes, and it really makes me wonder whether he's dead or not. I mean, if you're running a jihad, you want a symbolic figure out there to be running this. We'd be looking at forever. So we, you know, at the risk of a gross exaggeration, we could be fighting the wrong war. in Afghanistan, which looks to me like a civil war now, the Pashtuns against the Tajiks and the Shia. And trust me, in Afghanistan, you can never win a civil war there. So I think this administration should immediately look to pulling out of... I mean, look, we're supporting a former, you know, restaurant owner from Baltimore as president, whose family are the biggest heroin dealers in the world. This cannot come out well. You know, I know why we went in. There was no choice. You had to go into Afghanistan. You had to drive Taliban out and go after Qaeda. But the point is, we've outworn our welcome, and it's only going to become more expensive. People are getting kidnapped in Kabul. We cannot fix it for them. So this administration is going to be really tough if you're Obama to pull out of Afghanistan. Because what happens when, you know, you leave Kabul and bin Laden shows up, or somebody, or Zawahiri, his deputies show up and start a jihad again? Well, being ex-CIA, I just bombed the place, you know, until they finally gave up. But anyhow, so you've got political problems there. But on the other hand, we can't win. That is not a good news story. And the more we fight in Afghanistan and the more we go into the tribal areas, the more we're going to destabilize Pakistan. The Pakistanis are our allies. They do have nuclear weapons. They are trying to do the best they can of holding a very fractious country together. It's essentially five British provinces that are just holding on. And, you know, Obama said he's going to go into the tribal areas. Well, that's political rhetoric, I hope, because we're not going in any case.
Why do you think there hasn't been a terrorist attack on American soil since 9/11, or really a major one against American interests since then? And who was behind the London and Madrid bombings?
Good question. Look, in Sunni Islam, having just denigrated, in a sense, Sunnis, which I didn't mean to, I have very good friends that are Sunnis and the most cultivated and rational people probably in the world as well, but extremism rises every couple hundred years and to attack the system, to spread revolution, and it ultimately fails. And what happens is that there's a certain general disgust within the community, as among the Palestinians, the suicide bombers. In Saudi Arabia, notice there hasn't been an attack in years now, not since 2004, really a big attack. So you see that the Sunni community, in this, there's a spate of violence, and then it subsides and goes away for 100 years. So I think a lot of it to do is just the Muslims have turned against this violence. 9/11 has only gotten Muslims killed. They know it better than we do, and they're pulling back. Like, Afghanistan is nothing to do with Islamic fundamentalism. It's to do with a civil war right now. So the question is, why haven't they attacked the United States? I've been doing these films, and the more I do them, the more scared I get, because I sit down with bombers. I sat down with the guys who were partially responsible for the London, the tube bombing, and watched how easy it is to make this stuff. I mean, it's all on the internet, hair dye and acetone and black pepper as an oxidizer and a flash bulb, and you've got a bomb. And it's everywhere on the internet. Anybody can, they just, the question is, they don't want to. You look at the American Muslim community, and it's the last thing they want is an attack like that. And a bit to undermine my statement, look at the discipline in the American Muslim community. There hasn't been an attack, but in effect, there's nothing to stop an attack. These are based on cells, you know, one or two people, or even one person can do this alone. And that's a good news story, just turning away from violence. But it's not the fault of the FBI or the CIA, but the FBI cannot get in every single cell in a country of 300 million. Impossible in a democracy. It is the actual communities that have turned against this violence. You know, in Britain, you see mothers turning in their sons when they join these groups. And violence has fallen off in Britain. You know, the airplane bombing, I'm not sure was so serious. But the point, and there hasn't been an attack in Madrid, the attacks in Paris have fallen off. So if we go by historical precedent, this was a passing phase. Now, another big war in the Middle East could change that overnight.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Baer, former top CIA operative
in the Middle East about what Americans do and don't know about Iran and the Middle East. So tell us why you joined the CIA.
Besides, I think I was paid $300 a month at Bank of America. I never could count. I joined the CIA out of sheer curiosity. Church Pike. I come from a very liberal family. My mother used to teach at UCLA, the Little Red Schoolhouse, it was called in those days. I was at Berkeley, and I remember I had anarchist roommates who they would probably done me in right then to know if I'd applied. But I remember I had a picture of Mao Zedong, and the bottom was written, "The East Wind Blows Red." So the CIA is not a particularly conservative place. You'll find conservatives there. But once I got in, there's these huge databases that I just couldn't keep out of. It was like going to a university and watching the way the world, the National Security Agency, the Defense Department. And I was just absorbed by this curiosity and the curiosity of going to war areas in the Middle East to see what made these people tick. And that's really my interest in Iran, was this incredible ability of this national security apparatus to conduct war against a superpower and defeat us without using heavy weapons or nuclear weapons, or at least put us in a position as we are today as deterrence we can't really fight back at. And the Iranians are extraordinarily capable people and extraordinarily complicated. They have more sex change operations in Iran than they do anywhere in the world except Thailand. And that's not what you would consider a fundamentalist country. Or, their advances in nanotechnology. Or, I get off the plane, the Iranians ask me, did you bring us the new Jay-Z album? I didn't even know there was one. But, it's a complicated country. It's a police state, yet it's very modernizing. And it's very sophisticated. And when they talk about history 4,000 years old, about Zoroastrianism, and they celebrate holidays that are non-Muslim, this has a lot of meaning for them. And this is what we tend to miss. The country's far away, and we have other things to think about. Our problem is when you have Congress and the White House and the Pentagon and the press as well not focusing on Iran as a modernizing country that gets us into problems, because we could be lured into a conflict it wouldn't be easy to get out of.
One of the criticisms of the intelligence community after 9/11 was, and the issue of on-the-ground intelligence, the clandestine services. You mentioned you were in, some of your friends were killed in the bombing in Lebanon, the embassy in 83, where there was a meeting going on, I believe, at that time, that was some of the rationale for that bombing. So how would you assess the state of the clandestine services now? What type of people are joining the CIA? Is there really a push to recruit younger, intelligent members, and how crucial is that?
Let me say, and this isn't false humility, I could not get in the CIA today, my qualifications. You have a lot of smart people, Stanford, Ivy League, young kids that want to do something, and especially after 9/11, are applying, and they're getting in, and they've got a cadre of young officers who are extraordinarily capable. The problem is that they're running into the Washington politics, and they're being sent, for instance, to Iraq, where the CIA has only a minimal capability there because they're stuck in the green zone. Or if you go out, you need to go with security, and you can't do your job. You can't sit down with Iraqis at a restaurant if you got 20 guys from Blackwater sitting out, watching. Oh, it just doesn't work. That's not the way espionage works. So what the Bush administration has done is said, all right, you guys got to help us with Iraq, and the only thing the CIA can do is send more people. So if you got 600 people in Baghdad that sit in the green zone, sit in their pods, and it gets frustrating. And if you're smart and ambitious and you've got good Arabic, you say, all right, that's enough of this. And they come home, and the problem is going to be retaining them. If we could get the politics out of the CIA, it could serve a purpose. I say move the thing out of Washington, D.C., move it to San Francisco, Well, maybe that's not such a good idea. Maybe Seattle. Simply because we look at the Iraq War, and I thought that was so instructive because I used to run Iraqi operations. I was deputy chief and the chief for a while. And I knew we had no intelligence. So when the war came up, I said, what are they basing this on? This is all wrong. I mean, we just, you know, one of the most instructive things that's ever happened to me was in 1991, we detained 11 Iraqi generals. And we sat them down, and this is before Guantanamo techniques. We sat them down and we said, what were you guys thinking about invading Kuwait? And to a general, they said, we didn't know Saddam was going to invade Kuwait until 2 days before. Which tells me, as intelligence, how's the CIA ever going to know if 11 generals in the Iraqi army sitting around Saddam doesn't know what he's going to do? So, you know, Iraq was a black hole because Saddam kept his own counsel, barely told his sons anything. The few sources we had certainly did not come out and say that he kept his weapons of mass destruction. When his son-in-law came out, he said they were destroyed. We chose not to believe him. We didn't know. What the administration did was to cherry-pick bad intelligence, dress it up, and then put it in very fancy reports, top secret, specially compartmented information, and then hand it out to the New York Times and the Washington Post and say, look, we've got to go in. So this war was a merchandising campaign. And there we are. Now, unfortunately, the CIA, left to its own devices, would have probably said, you know, we think he's got weapons of mass destruction, but we don't know. And by the way, Mr. Bush, I wouldn't go into a preemptive war if we don't know. And that's the answer. You would have got out of the rank and file at the CIA. And as it turned out, you know, the pressure was put on. Cheney goes out to the CIA. George Tenet, the CIA director, wants into the White House, and the only way he's going to get in is if he says slam dunk. All very unfortunate, because in spite of my liberal background, in spite of, you know, having gone to Berkeley, it's an extremely useful organization to tell the truth, if you let it, and tell the truth to Congress. But once you involve politics, you're inevitably going to turn this thing into a propaganda machine.
The Iranians have an election in June. From a Western or American perspective, what's an outcome that might be most, I guess, beneficial? And what are the forces at work there that will really drive the issues internally for the Iranians? Oil prices, the economy,
well,
the war?
The problem with Iran right now is the economy. The mullahs have very little effect on the day-to-day lives of Iranians. Unemployment does. The price of oil falling. You know, it's great for us, but it's a little bit disturbing if the price of oil, let's say, goes down to $15 a barrel. I don't know that it will, but the worst case scenario. The Iranians starve, and it always worries me when you have a million-man army and a starving population. They tend to not just give up. They tend to expand or you know, move across the Gulf. I think what we could do with the Iranians, they have some of the most inefficient wells in the world. They're old wells. They need technology. And if we wanted to lower the temperature of Iran, we would go in and give them oil equipment. You know, look, we can keep the sanctions on. We can embargo the country, but they're not going to, you know, violate what they consider their national security interests. So we're doing no good. Sanctions have been on for 30 years. So why leave them on? Let's take them off as a gesture. You can always put them back on if something goes wrong. You can always embargo the country later on. But as long, again, as they're behaving in Iraq and Afghanistan, let's give them something.
You might argue that the entire focus on the Middle East, which the United States has had, has maybe since 1948 been focused on the issue of Israel as well as in oil. Would American energy independence dramatically shift our relationship and dealings with the Middle East? I mean, could it be a place we just turn our backs on if we had our own energy independence?
Well, I think we should. I think what's clear after Iraq and Afghanistan is that we're not going to impose democracy or American-style democracy in the Middle East. This is not going to happen. You know, things work differently there. I'll use the cliche, it is a mosaic. These people are going to find democracy on their own. They're going to settle their problems on their own. Most of the borders in the Middle East are artificial, but the last thing that's going to help that part of the world is if the West or the United States redraws the borders for them. This is what happened with Sykes-Picot in the first place when the Ottoman Empire broke up. So we can't redo the borders. we can't solve their problems. I think, you know, by pushing Israel into conflicts, they can't win. You know, in Lebanon, 1982, when they invaded, we're making it more insecure for Israel. And the other thing is, I just, you know, having been part of the imperial American bureaucracy, we don't do imperialism well. We're not 19th century Britain. We're not the French in Africa. We don't like it. We get tired of it very fast, and we don't like what you have to do to hold one of these countries together. So we should come home. I hope Obama's going to move into this, you know, energy independence, a Manhattan Project. We have to stop driving 2 hours to work and the rest of it. We just have to redo our economy and get out, because I don't see the sense in spending trillions and trillions of dollars to contain Iran, to hold Iraq together, because we will go broke. I mean, this will be the end of the American empire.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Baer, former top CIA operative, about what Americans do and don't know about Iran in the Middle East. The Iranian push to develop a nuclear capability or nuclear energy obviously has sort of been at the core of the relationship with the Bush administration. How realistic is it that they'll be successful getting that capability, either for the energy or the weapons grade? And if they get to the point where they test a weapon, you think they'll be allowed to get to that point, and what would then happen?
Well, the CIA has said very clearly that it suspended its weapons program. In national security issues like this, private citizens like me just can't say, well, that's not true, I don't believe it. If the CIA says, that's the best estimate we have. And frankly, for the CIA to say that they've suspended their nuclear weapons under this administration, an extraordinary change. I think it's thanks to Condoleezza Rice going over to State and Bob Gates at Defense. I mean, they're both, you know, voices of reason, more than the last crew. So they probably have suspended it, because they don't want to confront the United States. They don't want to give the United States justification. I would find it very difficult to believe that the Iranians are about to test a weapon. This is easily detectable. And should they get to the point where they've actually moved to a serious capability and weaponized, you know, enriched uranium, we'll know it. I think the Iranians are using the nuclear card as something they want to take to the bargaining table. We give them whatever it is they want, Iraq, Afghanistan, a predominant voice in those two countries, or in oil and the rest of it, and they'd be happy to trade in that card. I just can't see them risking a fight with Israel now, because they are a rational state, and unlike bin Laden, they are concerned about their own survival. Forget Ahmadinejad, what he says, and about the 12th Imam coming back. By and large, the Iranians don't believe that.
Do you think the Israelis would launch an attack on Iran without notifying the United States?
Oh, I think they have to overfly American positions. I mean, the question is, you know, we can have elections. If Netanyahu certainly sounds like he would want to go after Iran at this point, but we're going to have to wait for Iranian. I mean, the Israelis need the United States. They need us as a partner, and they need to be responsible. And they know as well as we do that a war with Iran would inflame the entire Gulf and hurt the United States deeply for many, many years, and I don't think they're going to do it. But, you know, we could wake up tomorrow morning and read the news. Who knows?
Historically, frequently American presidents are tested by something that comes out of nowhere, and it's usually an international crisis. Joe Biden, during the campaign, said he thought there will be such a test of the Obama administration. You want to venture to talk about where you see that might be coming from or what that could mean?
Well, my bias is, I mean, I spent my career mostly, and I spent it in Russia as well, but I think it's going to be the Middle East. State Department, the CIA, their worst fear is an accident. An American helicopter strays across the border into Iran, the Iranians shoot it down, the military responds, thinks it's an act of aggression. So everybody in the bureaucracy is waiting for that accident to occur, as the Iranians are, and I think that should be our biggest fear. I think with the Russians, you'd have Putin certainly would like to reestablish the empire. If we provoke him enough, he'll invade another country, Azerbaijan next, who knows. But I think the Russians aren't much of a threat, especially with the price of oil going down.
So if you were doing a risk assessment from an international perspective, where does Iran stack up in terms of, you know, where the threat or factor, or in terms of looking at what prices could explode?
I think on the 20th of January, I would start right away. We cannot keep on kicking this can down the road, Iran. You've got to figure out what they want. And the only way to figure out is go ask them and test them. And I think it's definitely Iran. And the catalyst for a conflict in Iran wouldn't be just the Gulf. It could be in Gaza. The Iranians are sending weapons to the Palestinians. The Israelis at some point may have to go into Gaza, which could ignite a conflict in Egypt. And these dominoes would fall very quickly.
So I think one of the things you've said today that's pretty clear is that your advice would be to open a dialogue with the Iranians, and that really is a step that they want to be talked to, they want to be addressed, they want to be respected. Is that a cultural thing, or how does that play out with them?
Well, the Iranians, they have a certain superiority complex. They do look at history, and they do look at their empire, and they do look at very well-educated people, and they focus on the fact that they are a country that lived in the same borders, and they say, look, we didn't attack you on 9/11. It was, you know, Saudis that attacked you. And why do you guys pay any attention to Pakistan? It's on the edge. You know, it's going to fall apart. So why are you dismissing us like this? Why do you put us in why do you demand that we do certain things before you talk to us? There's a certain amount of Persian pride, and they're going to ultimately overplay their hand, and they're going to fail in Iraq eventually. The Iraqis will split with them. But until then, it does no good at all to speak down to them. We're not going to get anything. It's a waste of time. We're going to push them into a corner, and the possibility of the conflict will go up immeasurably.
When you look back, I guess you were out of the agency in the early 90s, but when the Bush administration made its decisions after 9/11, and I guess this has been turned over a lot, but from what you've seen and what you know, how much was really ignored, or was there a decision of mindset really to go after Saddam no matter what, in terms of what people really knew in the White House and what the president sort of was exposed to in terms of briefings and knowledge?
Oh, they were determined to go in. I mean, the moment, you know, the dust cleared from the World Trade Center, the decision was made to go into Iraq. It was a pillar of the neocons, that you change Iraq, the change of regime there, and the rest of the Middle East will fall into place. The neocons knew that Iran was a bridge too far. They always held out the possibility that Iran and Israel could ally one day. So they wanted to get Saddam. It was very much an internal, but it was not driven by the intelligence community that I saw. What amazed me was when the press went along with it. I am the least important man in the room, but I was, you know, desperately trying to promote a book, and I knew every journalist in Washington. If you ever promoted a book, it's you're out there. So they knew who I was. And there was only one journalist that asked me if, you know, I knew Judy Miller, sat down with her, and she didn't want to hear any of this, you know. She was getting phone calls. No, the investigative reporter at the New York Times was getting phone calls from Judy Miller from Doug Feith's house at the Pentagon, because he read on his caller ID Doug Feith, trying to kill stories at the New York Times. Washington and the establishment was all culpable in this decision. It was like the decision they made was to go into Iraq, and everybody went along with it if they're patriots. And this was all based on the fear of 9/11. You can get away with a lot of things when this kind of fear runs through a society.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's a time for only one last question and a quick answer. Let's talk a little bit. I know this is sort of a setup. Saudi Arabia, you really haven't mentioned it. But
that's my favorite.
I didn't ask you about it, but where does this Saudis factor in all this? If you can answer that in 1 minute, you win.
just 1 minute. The Saudis don't have a military. We need support in the Middle East. We need somebody with soldiers on the ground. We need somebody with an air force. The Saudis don't have it. They pump our oil cheaply. And I don't really care who rules in Saudi Arabia myself. So if the royal family were to leave tomorrow, I could say something ugly in Arabic, but I'll, you know, good riddance. It doesn't matter to us.
Okay.
Our thanks to Robert Baer, former CIA operative and author of the new book, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower, for his comments this evening. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.